army talked of nothing but the honors or sums of money which were to be their rewards, or of vengeance on their enemies, and never considered how they were to defeat their enemies, only in what manner they should use their victory. Corn being provided and my soldiers refreshed, and a sufficient time having elapsed since the engagement at Dyrrhachium, when I thought I had sufficiently sounded the disposition of my troops, I thought that I ought to test whether Pompey had any intention or inclination to come to a battle. Accordingly, I led my troops out of the camp, and arranged them in order of battle, at first on their own ground and at a small distance from Pompey's camp. But afterward, for several days in succession, I advanced from my camp and led them up to the hills on which Pompey's troops were posted. This conduct inspired my army every day with fresh courage. However, I adhered to my former purpose respecting my cavalry, for as I was by many degrees inferior in number, I selected the youngest and most active of the advanced guard, and desired them to fight intermixed with the horse, and they by constant practice acquired experience in this kind of battle. By these means it was brought to pass that 1,000 of my horse would dare even on open ground to stand against 7,000 of Pompey's, if occasion required, and would not be much terrified by their number. Even on one of those days I was successful in a cavalry action, and killed one of the 2 Allobrogians who had deserted to Pompey, as I before observed, and several others. Because he was encamped on a hill, Pompey drew up his army at the very foot of it, ever in expectation, as may be conjectured, that I would expose myself to this disadvantageous situation. Seeing no likelihood of being able to bring Pompey to an action, I judged it the most expedient method of conducting the war to decamp from that post, and to be always in motion, with this hope that by shifting my camp and moving from place to place, I might be more conveniently supplied with corn, and also that by being in motion I might get some opportunity of forcing the battle, and might by constant marches harass Pompey's army, which was not accustomed to fatigue. These matters being settled, when the signal for marching was given and the tents struck, it was observed that shortly before, contrary to his daily practice, Pompey's army had advanced further than usual from his entrenchments, so that it appeared possible to come to an action on equal ground. Then I addressed myself to my soldiers, when they were at the gates of the camp ready to march out, saying, "We must defer our march at present, and set our thoughts on battle, which has been our constant wish. Let us then meet the foe with resolute souls. We shall not hereafter easily find such an opportunity." I immediately marched out at the head of my troops. Pompey, as was afterward discovered, at the unanimous solicitation of his friends, had determined to try the fate of a battle, for he had even declared in council a few days prior, before the battalions came to battle, that my army would be put to the rout. When most people expressed their surprise at this, he said, "I know that I promise a thing almost incredible, but hear the plan on which I proceed, that you may march to battle with more confidence and resolution. I have persuaded our cavalry, and they have engaged to execute it, as soon as our 2 armies have met, to attack Caesar's right wing on the flank, and enclosing their army on the rear, throw them into disorder, and put them to the rout, before we shall throw a weapon against the enemy. By this means we shall put an end to the war, without endangering the legions, and almost without a blow. Nor is this a difficult matter, as we far outnumber them in cavalry." At the same time, Pompey gave them notice to be ready for battle the next day, and since the opportunity which they had so often wished for had then arrived, not to disappoint the opinion generally entertained of their experience and valor. After him, Labienus spoke, as well to express his contempt of my forces, as to extol Pompey's scheme with the highest encomiums. He said, "Think not, Pompey, that Caesar's is the army which conquered Gaul and Germany. I was present at those battles, and do not speak at random on a subject to which I am a stranger. A very small part of that army now remains. Great numbers lost their lives, as must necessarily happen in so many battles. Many fell victims to the autumnal pestilence in Italy. Many returned home, and many were left behind on the continent. Have you not heard that the cohorts at Brundusium are composed of invalids? The forces which you now behold have been recruited by levies lately made in hither Spain, and the greater part from the colonies beyond the Po. Moreover, the flower of the forces perished in the two engagements at Dyrrhachium. Having said this, Labienus took an oath never to return to his camp unless victorious, and he encouraged the rest to do the same. Pompey applauded his proposal, and took the same oath, nor did any person present hesitate to take it. After this had passed in the council, they broke up full of hopes and joy, and in imagination anticipated victory, because they thought that in a matter of such importance, no groundless assertion could be made by a general of such experience. I had approached near Pompey's camp, and observed that his army was drawn up in the following manner. On the left wing were the two legions, delivered over by me at the beginning of the disputes in compliance with the Senate's decree, one of which was called the First, the other the Third. Here Pompey commanded in person. Scipio, with the Syrian legions, commanded the center. The Cilician legion, in conjunction with the Spanish cohorts, which we said were brought over by Afranius, were dispatched on the right wing. These Pompey considered his steadiest troops. The rest he had interspersed between the center and the wing, and he had 110 complete cohorts. These amounted to 45,000 men. He had also two cohorts of volunteers, who, having received favors from him in former wars, flocked to his standard. These were dispersed through his whole army. The seven remaining cohorts he had disposed to protect his camp and the neighboring forts. His right wing was secured by a river with steep banks. For this reason he placed all his cavalry, archers, and slingers on his left wing. I observed my former custom, and placed the 10th legion on the right, the 9th on the left, although it was very much weakened by the battles at Dyrrhachium. I placed the 8th legion so close to the 9th as to almost make one of the two, and ordered them to support one another. I drew up on the field 80 cohorts, making a total of 22,000 men. I left two cohorts to guard the camp. I gave the command of the left wing to Antonius, the right to Publius Sulla, and the center to Cneius Domitius. I myself took my post opposite Pompey. At the same time, fearing from the disposition of the enemy which we have previously mentioned, lest my right wing might be surrounded by their numerous cavalry, I rapidly drafted a single cohort from each of the legions composing the third line, formed of them a fourth line, and opposed them to Pompey's cavalry. Acquainting them with my wishes, I admonished them that the success of that day depended on their courage. At the same time I ordered the third line and the entire army not to charge without my command, that I would give the signal whenever I wished them to do so. When I was exhorting my army to battle, according to the military custom, and spoke to them of the favors that they had constantly received from me, I took special care to remind them that I could call my soldiers to witness the earnestness with which I had sought peace. The efforts that I had made by Vatinius to gain a conference with Labienus, and likewise by Claudius to treat with Scipio. The manner of exertion at Oricum to gain permission from Libo to send ambassadors, that I had been always reluctant to shed the blood of my soldiers, and did not wish to deprive the Republic of one or other of her armies. After delivering this speech, I gave by a trumpet the signal to my soldiers, who were eagerly demanding it, and were very impatient for the onset. There was in my army a volunteer of the name of Crastinus, who the year before had been first centurion of the 10th Legion, a man of preeminent bravery. He, when the signal was given, said, "Follow me, my old comrades, and display such exertions on behalf of your general as you have determined to do. This is our last battle, and when it shall be won, he will recover his dignity, and we our liberty." At the same time he looked back to me and said, "General, I will act in such a manner today that you will feel grateful to me living or dead." After uttering these words, he charged first on the right wing, and about 120 chosen volunteers of the same century followed. There was as much space left between the two lines as sufficed for the onset of the hostile armies. But Pompey had ordered his soldiers to await my attack, and not to advance from their position, or suffer their line to be put into disorder, and he is said to have done this by the advice of Caius Triarius, that the impetuosity of the charge of my soldiers might be checked, and our line broken, and that Pompey's troops remaining in their ranks might attack us while in disorder. And he thought that the javelins would fall with less force if the soldiers were kept in their ground than if they met them in their course. At the same time he trusted that my soldiers, after running over double the usual ground, would become weary and exhausted by the fatigue. But to me, Pompey seems to have acted without sufficient reason, for there is a certain impetuosity of spirit and an alacrity implanted by nature in the hearts of all men, which is inflamed by a desire to meet the foe. This a general should endeavor not to repress, but to increase. Nor was it a vain institution of our ancestors that the trumpets should sound on all sides, and a general shout be raised, by which they imagined that the enemy were struck with terror, and their own army inspired with courage. But our men, when the signal was given, rushed forward with their javelins ready to be launched. Perceiving that Pompey's men did not run to meet their charge, having acquired experience by custom, and being practiced in former battles, they of their own accord repressed their speed, and halted almost midway, that they might not come up with the enemy when their strength was exhausted. And after a short respite they again renewed their course, and threw their javelins, and instantly drew their swords as I had ordered them. Nor did Pompey's men fail in this crisis, for they received our javelins, stood our charge, and maintained their ranks, and having launched their javelins had recourse to their swords. At the same time Pompey's horse, according to their orders, rushed out at once from his left wing, and his whole host of archers poured after them. Our cavalry did not withstand their charge, but gave ground a little, upon which Pompey's horse pressed them more vigorously, and began to file off in troops and flank our army. When I perceived this, I gave the signal to my fourth line, which I had formed of the six cohorts. They instantly rushed forward and charged Pompey's horse with such fury that not a man of them stood. All wheeling about, they not only quit their post, but galloped forward to seek a refuge in the highest mountains. By their retreat, the archers and slingers, being left destitute and defenseless, were all cut to pieces. The cohorts, pursuing their success, wheeled about on Pompey's left wing, while his infantry still continued to make battle and attacked in the rear. At the same time I ordered my third line to advance, which until then had not been engaged, but had kept their post. Thus new and fresh troops having come to the assistance of the fatigued, and others having made an attack on their rear, Pompey's men were not able to maintain their ground, but all fled. I was not deceived in my opinion that the victory, as I had declared in my speech to my soldiers, must have its beginning from those six cohorts, which I had placed as a fourth line to oppose the horse. By them the cavalry were routed, by them the archers and slingers were cut to pieces, by them the left wing of Pompey's army was surrounded, and obliged to be the first to flee. But when Pompey saw his cavalry routed, and that part of his army on which he reposed his greatest hopes thrown into confusion. Despairing of the rest, he quit the field, and retreated straightway on horseback to his camp, and calling to the centurions whom he had placed to guard the Praetorian gate, with a loud voice that the soldiers might hear, he yelled, "Secure the camp, defend it with diligence. If any danger should threaten it, I will visit the other gates, and encourage the guards of the camp." Having thus spoken, he retired into his tent, in utter despair, anxiously awaiting the outcome. I forced the Pompeians to flee into their entrenchment, thinking that I ought not to allow them any respite to recover from their fright. I exhorted my soldiers to take advantage of fortune's kindness, and to attack the camp. Though they were fatigued by the intense heat, for the battle had continued till midday, yet being prepared to undergo any labor, they cheerfully obeyed my command. The camp was bravely defended by the cohorts which had been left to guard it, but with much more spirit by the Thracians and foreign auxiliaries. The soldiers who had fled for refuge to it from the field of battle, frightened and exhausted by fatigue, having thrown away their arms and military standards, had their thoughts more engaged on their further escape than on the defense of the camp. Nor could the troops who were posted on the battlements long withstand the immense number of our darts, but, fainting under their wounds, quit the place, and under the conduct of their centurions and tribunes, fled, without stopping, to the high mountains which join the camp. In Pompey's camp you might have seen arbors in which tables were laid, a large quantity of plates set out, the floors of the tents covered with fresh sod, the tents of Lucius Lentulus and others shaded with ivy, and many other things which were proofs of excessive luxury and a confidence of victory, so that it might readily be inferred that they had no apprehensions of the issue of the day, as they indulged themselves in unnecessary pleasures, and yet upbraided with luxury my army, distressed and suffering troops who had always been lacking in common necessities. Pompey, as soon as our men had forced the trenches, mounting his horse, and stripping off his general's habit, went hastily out of the back gate of the camp, and galloped with all speed to Larissa. Nor did he stop there, but with the same dispatch collecting a few of his fleeing troops, and halting neither day nor night, he arrived at the seaside, attended by only 30 horse, and went on board a victualling bark, often complaining, as we've been told, that he had been so deceived in his expectation that he was almost persuaded that he had been betrayed by those from whom he had expected victory, as they began the fight. I took possession of Pompey's camp, urging my soldiers not to be too intent on plunder, and thereby lose the opportunity of completing our conquest. Having obtained their consent, I began to draw lines around the mountain. The Pompeians, distrusting the position, as there was no water on the mountain, abandoned it, and all began to retreat toward Larissa. I perceived this, and divided my troops and ordered part of my legions to remain in Pompey's camp. I sent back a portion to my own camp, and taking 4 legions with me, went by a shorter road to intercept the enemy. Having marched 6 miles, I drew up my army. But the Pompeians, observing this, took post on a mountain, whose foot was washed by a river. I encouraged my troops, though they were greatly exhausted by incessant labor the whole day, and night was now approaching. By putting up works, we cut off the communication between the river and the mountain, that the enemy might not get water in the night. As soon as the work was finished, we sent ambassadors to treat about a capitulation. A few senators who had sighted that party made their escape by night. At the break of day, I ordered all those of the enemy who had taken post on the mountain to come down from the higher grounds into the plain and pile their arms. When they did this without refusal and with outstretched arms, prostrating themselves on the ground, with tears implored my mercy. I comforted them and bade them arise, and having spoken a few words of my own clemency to alleviate their fears, I pardoned them all and gave orders to my soldiers that no injury should be done to them, and nothing taken from them. Having used this diligence, I ordered the legions in my camp to come and meet me, and those who were with me to take their turn of rest, and go back to the camp, and the same day we went to Larissa. In that battle, no more than 200 privates were missing, but I lost about 30 centurions, valiant officers. Crastinus also, of whom mention was made before, fighting most courageously, lost his life by the wound of a sword in the mouth. It was not false what he declared when marching to battle. I entertained the highest opinion of his behavior in that battle, and thought him highly deserving of approbation. Of Pompey's army there fell about 15,000, but upwards of 24,000 were made prisoners. Even the cohorts which were stationed in the forts surrendered to Sylla. Several others took shelter in the neighboring states. 180 stands of colors and 9 eagles were brought to me. Lucius Domitius, fleeing from the camp to the mountains, his strength being exhausted by fatigue, was killed by the horsemen. About this time Decimus Laelius arrived with his fleet at Brundusium, and in the same manner as Libo had done before, took possession of an island opposite the harbor of Brundusium. In like manner Valinius, who was then governor of Brundusium, with a few decked barks, endeavored to entice Laelius's fleet, and took 1 5-banked galley and 2 smaller vessels that had ventured further than the rest into a narrow part of the harbor, and likewise, dispatching the horse along the shore, strove to prevent the enemy from procuring fresh water. But Laelius, having chosen a more convenient season of the year for his expedition, supplied himself with water brought by transports from Corcyra and Dyrrachium, and was not deterred from his purpose, and until he had received advice of the battle in Thessaly, he could not be forced either by the disgrace of losing his ships, or by the lack of necessities, to quit the port or islands. At around the same time, Cassius arrived in Sicily with a fleet of Syrians, Phoenicians, and Cilicians. As my fleet was divided into 2 parts, Publius Sulpicius, the praetor, commanding 1 division at Vibo near the straits, Pomponius the other at Messana, Cassius got into Messana with his fleet, before Pomponius had notice of his arrival, and having found him in disorder, without guards or discipline, and the wind being high and favorable, he filled several transports with fir, pitch, and tow, and other combustibles, and sent them against Pomponius's fleet, and set fire to all his ships, 35 in number, 20 of which were armed with beaks. This action caused such terror that though there was a legion in garrison at Messana, the town with difficulty held out. And had not the news of my victory been brought at that instant by the horse stationed along the coast, it was generally imagined that it would have been lost. The town was maintained till the news arrived very opportunely, and Cassius set sail from there to attack Sulpicius's fleet at Vibo. Our ships being moored to the land, and to strike the same terror, he acted in the same manner as before. The wind being favorable, he sent into the port about 40 ships, provided with combustibles, and the flame catching on both sides, 5 ships were burned to ashes. When the fire began to spread wider by the violence of the wind, the soldiers of the veteran legions who had been left to guard the fleet, being considered as invalids, could not endure the disgrace, but of themselves went on board the ships and weighed anchor, and having attacked Cassius's fleet, captured 2 5-banked galleys, in one of which was Cassius himself. But he made his escape. He took to a boat. 2 3-banked galleys were taken too. Intelligence was shortly received of the action in Thessaly, so well authenticated, that the Pompeians themselves gave credit to it, because they had hitherto believed it a fiction of my lieutenants and friends. Upon this intelligence, Cassius departed with his fleet from that coast. I thought I ought to postpone all business and pursue Pompey, wherever he should retreat to, that he might not be able to provide fresh forces and renew the war. I therefore marched every day as far as my cavalry were able to advance, and ordered one legion to follow me by shorter journeys. A proclamation was issued by Pompey at Amphipolis that all the young men of that province, Grecians and Roman citizens, should take the military oath. But whether he issued it with an intention of preventing suspicion, and to conceal as long as possible his design of fleeing further, or to endeavor to keep possession of Macedonia by new levies, if nobody pursued him, it is impossible to judge. He lay at anchor one night, and calling together his friends in Amphipolis, and collecting a sum of money for his necessary expenses, upon advice of my approach, he set sail from that place, and arrived in a few days at Mytilene. Here he was detained 2 days, and having added a few galleys to his fleet, he went to Cilicia, and from there to Cyprus. There he was informed by the consent of all the inhabitants of Antioch and Roman citizens who traded there, that the castle had been seized to shut him out of the town, and that messengers had been dispatched to all those who were reported to have taken refuge in the neighboring states, that they should not come to Antioch, that if they did, that it would be attended with imminent danger to their lives. The same thing had happened to Lucius Lentulus, who had been consul the year before, and to Publius Lentulus, a consular senator, and to several others at Rhodes, who, having followed Pompey in his flight and arrived at the island, were not admitted into the town or port. And having received a message to leave that neighborhood, they set sail much against their will. That's because the rumor of my approach had now reached those states. Pompey, being informed of these proceedings, laid aside his design of going to Syria, and having taken the public money from the farmers of the revenue, and borrowed more from some private friends, and having put on board his ships a large quantity of brass for military purposes, and 2,000 armed men, whom he partly selected from the slaves of the tax farmers, and partly collected from the merchants, and such persons as each of his friends thought fit on this occasion, he sailed for Pelusium. It so happened that King Ptolemy, a minor, was there with a considerable army, engaged in war with his sister Cleopatra, who a few months before, by the assistance of his relations and friends, he had expelled from the kingdom, and her camp lay at a small distance from his. To Ptolemy, Pompey applied to be permitted to take refuge in Alexandria, and to be protected in his calamity by his powerful assistants, in consideration of the friendship and amity which had subsisted between his father and he. But Pompey's deputies, having executed their commission, began to converse with less restraint with the king's troops, and to advise them to act with friendship to Pompey, and not to think meanly of his bad fortune. In Ptolemy's army were several of Pompey's soldiers, of whom Gabinius had received the command in Syria, and had brought them over to Alexandria, and at the conclusion of the war had left with Ptolemy the father of the young king. The king's friends, who were regents of the kingdom during the minority, were informed of these things, either induced by fear, as they afterward declared, lest Pompey should corrupt the king's army and seize on Alexandria and Egypt, or, despising his bad fortune, as in adversity friends commonly change to enemies, in public they gave a favorable answer to his deputies, and desired him to come to the king, but secretly laid a plot against him, and dispatched Achillas, captain of the king's guards, a man of singular boldness, and Lucius Septimius, a military tribune, to assassinate him. Being kindly addressed by them, and deluded by an acquaintance with Septimius, because in the war with the pirates the latter had commanded a company under him, he embarked in a small boat with a few attendants, and was murdered there by Achillas and Septimius. In like manner, Lucius Lentulus was seized by the king's order, and put to death in prison. When I arrived in Asia, I found that Titus Ampius had attempted to remove the money from the Temple of Diana at Ephesus. For this purpose, he had convened all the senators in the province so he might have them to attest to the sum. But he was interrupted by my arrival and had made his escape. Thus, on two occasions, I saved the money of Ephesus. It was also remarked at Elis in the Temple of Minerva, upon calculating and enumerating the days, that on the very day on which I had gained my battle, the image of victory which was placed before Minerva and faced her statue turned about toward the portal and entrance of the temple. And the same day at Antioch in Syria, such a shout of an army and sound of trumpets was twice heard that the citizens ran in arms to the walls. The same thing happened at Ptolemais. A sound of drums, too, was heard at Pergamos, in the private and retired parts of the temple, into which none but the priests are allowed admission, and which the Greeks call adita, the inaccessible, and likewise at Tralles, in the Temple of Victory, in which there stood a statue consecrated to me. A palm tree at that time was displayed that had sprouted up from the pavement, through the joints of the stones, and shot up above the roof. After a few days' delay in Asia, having heard that Pompey had been seen in Cyprus, and conjecturing that he had directed his course into Egypt, on account of his connection with that kingdom, I set out for Alexandria with two legions, one of which I ordered to follow me from Thessaly, the other I called in from Achaia, from Fufius, the lieutenant general, and with 800 horse, 10 ships of war from Rhodes, and a few from Asia. These legions amounted only to 3,200 men, the rest disabled by wounds received in various battles, by fatigue and the length of their march, could not follow me. But I relied on the fame of my exploits, and did not hesitate to set forward with a feeble force, and thought that I would be secure anywhere. At Alexandria I was informed of the death of Pompey, and at my landing there heard a cry among the soldiers who the king had left to garrison the town, and saw a crowd gathering toward me, because the fasces were carried in front of me. This the whole multitude thought was an infringement of the king's dignity. Though this tumult was appeased, frequent disturbances were raised for several days successively, by crowds of the populace, and a great many of my soldiers were killed in all parts of the city. Having observed this, I ordered other legions to be brought to me from Asia, which I had made up out of Pompey's soldiers, for I was detained against his will by the Etesian winds, which were totally unfavorable to one on a voyage from Alexandria. Meanwhile, considering that the disputes of the princes belonged to the jurisdiction of the Roman people, and of myself as consul, and that it was a duty more incumbent on me, as in my former consulate a league had been made with Ptolemy the late king, under sanction both of a law and a decree of the Senate, I signified that it was my pleasure that King Ptolemy and his sister Cleopatra should disband their armies and decide their disputes in my presence by justice rather than by the sword. A eunuch named Pothinus, the boy's tutor, was regent of the kingdom on account of his youthfulness. He at first began to complain among his friends, and to express his indignation that the king should be summoned to plead his cause. But afterward, having prevailed on some of those who he had made acquainted with his views to join him, he secretly called the army away from Pelusium to Alexandria, and appointed Achillas, already mentioned, commander-in-chief of the forces. Achillas was encouraged and animated by promises, both in Pothinus's and the king's name, and instructed him, both by letters and messages, how he should act. By the will of Ptolemy the father, the elder of his two sons and the more advanced in years of his two daughters were declared his heirs, and for the more effectual performance of my intention, in the same will, Ptolemy conjured the Roman people by all the gods, and by the league which he had entered into at Rome, to see his will executed. One of the copies of his will was conveyed to Rome by ambassadors to be deposited in the treasury, but the public troubles preventing that, it was lodged with Pompey. Another was left sealed up and kept at Alexandria. While these things were debated before me, being very anxious to settle the royal disputes as a common friend and arbitrator, news was brought suddenly that the king's army and all his cavalry were on their march to Alexandria. My forces were by no means so strong that I could trust to them if I had occasion to hazard a battle outside the town. My only resource was to keep within the town in the most convenient places and get information of Achillas's plans. However, I ordered my soldiers to repair to their arms and advised the king to send some of his friends, who had the greatest influence, as deputies to Achillas, and to signify his royal pleasure. Dioscorides and Serapion, the people sent by him, who had both been ambassadors at Rome, and had been in great esteem with Ptolemy the Father, went to Achillas. But as soon as they appeared in his presence, without hearing him or learning the occasion of their coming, he ordered them to be seized and put to death. One of them, after receiving a wound, was taken up and carried off by his attendants as if he was dead. The other was killed on the spot. With this, I took care to secure the king's person, both supposing that the king's name would have a great influence with his subjects, and to give the war the appearance of the scheme of a few desperate men, rather than of having been begun by the king's consent. The forces under Achillas did not seem despicable, either for number, spirit, or military experience. He had 20,000 men under arms. They consisted partly of Gabinius's soldiers, who had now become habituated to the licentious mode of living at Alexandria, and had forgotten the name and discipline of the Roman people. He had married wives there, by whom the greatest part of them had children. To these was added a collection of highwaymen and freebooters from Syria and the province of Cilicia and the adjacent countries. And several convicts and transports had been collected. At Alexandria, all our runaway slaves were sure of finding protection for themselves on the condition that they should give in their names and enlist as soldiers. And if any of them was apprehended by his master, they were rescued by a crowd of his fellow soldiers, who, being involved in the same guilt, repelled, at the hazard of their lives, every violence offered to any of their body. These, by a prescriptive privilege of the Alexandrian army, used to demand the king's favorites to be put to death, pillage the properties of the rich to increase their pay, invest the king's palace, banish some from the kingdom, and recall others from exile. With these there were 2,000 horse, who had acquired the skill of veterans by being in several wars in Alexandria. These had restored Ptolemy the Father to his kingdom, had killed Bibulus's two sons, and had been engaged in war with the Egyptians. This was their experience in military affairs. Full of confidence in his troops, and despising the small number of my soldiers, Achillas seized Alexandria, except that part of the town which I occupied with my troops. At first he attempted to force the palace, but I dispatched my cohorts through the streets and repelled his attack. At the same time there was an action at the port, where the contest was maintained with the greatest obstinacy. The forces were divided, and the fight maintained in several streets at once, and the enemy endeavored to seize with a strong party the ships of war, of which 50 had been sent to Pompey's assistance, but after the battle in Thessaly they had returned home. They were all of either 3 or 5 banks of oars, well equipped and appointed with every necessity for a voyage. Besides these, there were 22 vessels with decks, which were usually kept at Alexandria to guard the port. If they made themselves masters of these, I being deprived of my fleet, they would have the command of the port and whole sea, and could prevent procuring provisions and auxiliaries. Accordingly, that spirit was displayed, which ought to be displayed when the one party saw that a speedy victory depended on the issue, and the other their safety. But I gained the day, and set fire to all those ships, and to others which were in the docks. I could not guard so many places with so small a force. Immediately I conveyed some troops to the Pharos with my ships. The Pharos is a tower on an island, of prodigious height, built with amazing works. It takes its name from the island. This island, lying over against Alexandria, forms a harbor, but on the upper side it is connected with the town by a narrow way 800 paces in length, made by piles sunk in the sea, and by a bridge. In this island some of the Egyptians have houses, and a village as large as a town. Whatever ships from any quarter, either through mistaking the channel or by the storm, have been driven from their course upon the coast, they constantly plunder like pirates, and without the consent of those who are masters of the Pharos, no vessels can enter the harbor, on account of its narrowness. I was greatly alarmed at this, and while the enemy was engaged in battle, I landed my soldiers, seized the Pharos, and placed a garrison in it. By this means I gained this point, so I could be supplied without danger with corn and auxiliaries. I sent word to all the neighboring countries, demanding supplies. In other parts of the town the fighting was so obstinate that both sides quit the field with equal advantage, and neither were beaten in consequence of the narrowness of the passes. A few being killed on both sides, I secured the most necessary posts, and fortified them in the night. In this quarter of the town was a wing of the king's palace, in which I was lodged on my first arrival, as well as a theater adjoining the house which served as a citadel. I commanded an avenue to the ports and other docks. These fortifications I increased during the succeeding days, so I might have them in front of me as a rampart, and not be obliged to fight against my will. In the meantime, Ptolemy's younger daughter, hoping the throne would become vacant, made her escape from the palace to Achillas, and assisted him in prosecuting the war. But they soon fought about the command, a circumstance which enlarged the presents to the soldiers, for each endeavored by great sacrifices to secure their affection. And while the enemy was thus employed, Pothinus, tutor to the young king, and regent of the kingdom, who was in my part of the town, sent messengers to Achillas, and encouraged him not to desist from his enterprise, nor to despair of success. But his messengers were discovered, and they were apprehended, and I put Pothinus to death. That was how the Alexandrian War began. You have been listening to The Works of Julius Caesar, The Civil Wars, by Julius Caesar, narrated by Jack Chakijian. This text, published in 1869, is in the public domain. This recording, production copyright 2018, was produced by Jack Chakijian in cooperation with the Audio Production Network at Spoken Realms, on the web at SpokenRealms.com. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.